Mavericks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Movie Mavericks, speaking of fucking long, uncut European cocks.
The Movie Mavericks Podcast.
Now for your hosts, Jason and Trevor.
I can't wait.
Hey now, everybody. Welcome to a special episode of the Movie Mavericks Podcast, or as I like to call it, The Other Side of Safety. I'm Trevor Anderson, sitting over Jason Rugard. He'll tell you what the hell that means.
That's the tagline for today's retrospective episode, 1996's Van Damme's flop, Maximum Risk. Yeah, this is the Ringo Lam directed. This was the first of three pictures that Van Damme had signed to do with Sony, Columbia, and they all three were massive box office disappointments.
And this was one of the first three films he'd do with Ringo Lam.
Right. Yeah, this was the first, you know, Van Damme was the guy that brought over John Woo. He is the guy that brought over Ringo Lam. And this is his first collaboration with Lam. And you're particularly fond of their second collaboration, or third, I would say.
I like all of them.
Yeah, I will say that they work well together.
Replicant is very good. Also, you know, Twinsies and Replicant. In Hell, excellent film. But should we address, I mean, the Twins thing? Like, what's with Van Damme and Twins?
Yeah, this is definitely the Corsican brothers of the Van Damme films. You know, he did this obviously in Double Impact, which is, you know, if you're talking about Van Damme movies,
and
first
Replicant
of all,
to a degree, right? Obviously, they weren't really brothers, but you know,
right? But he's playing twin type characters, and obviously this one as well. Even though the character gets killed off in the very beginning, but if you're going to talk about Van Damme and his career, you got to really talk about it like you do Seagal's career. And even though they have different problems for why they fell off. Right around 1996 is when they both had films that were really faltering. You know, they'd hit their kind of zenith in 94 to 95.
And you have to admit, the next year after this, when Double Team came out, I mean, my God.
Really bad.
And then Knockoff, and then Legionnaire. I mean, just like, holy shit, buddy.
Well, yeah, and even to say that for Seagal, you know, you have the Glimmer Man in 96, and then it followed by Fire Down Below and The Patriot and things like that, you know. So it really goes downhill for these guys. They, like I said, they'd hit their peak in the early part of the 90s, if not the mid-90s. But if you go back and look at this, and of the two movies that were released in 1996 as Seagal's Glimmer Man and Van Damme's Maximum Risk, I do think this is the stronger of the two movies.
I would disagree. I think I like Glimmer Man more than this.
Glimmer Man's a little bit easier to watch because it's a little bit it's not as complex of what it's trying to do, I think. I think it's a little bit smoother.
Well, there's absolutely nothing complex going on in Maximum Risk. I don't know what movie you watched. I'm actually unsure of what you're talking about here. I mean, Maximum Risk takes about, you know, minimum brain power to watch.
Well, also, this was Van Damme's third film in the course of less than 12 months. He had done Sudden Death in late 95, The Quest, which he wrote and directed in early 96, and then this in late, you know, fall of 96. So really, I think, oversaturated himself, kind of what Jason Statham did there for a quick second, you know, and kind of everything became a blur of itself, even though I saw all these in the theater. Did you catch this one in the theater as a kid?
I did not. I didn't see this one. I mean, really, when you're talking about Van Damme's, like, heyday, you're kind of talking the early 90s.
What is Van Damme's heyday to you? Like, what is the movie that best represents a Van Damme movie for you?
I mean, that's hard to say because he does, you know, he does action movies, but he also does sci-fi stuff. So, I mean, for me, you know, Time Cop, obviously. But, you know, but then right there's Hard Target as well, right? Universal Soldier. Yeah, so it's hard. I mean, Cyborg, obviously, my Bloodsport, if you go back into the 80s. So it's hard to say that he's one or the other, right? He kind of does both.
Well, it's interesting you brought up Hard Target and Universal Soldier, both movies I've watched recently and have found them to be lacking severely from what I remember them as a kid. They were very, very good. I mean, those are movies I watched all the time, and I've watched them recently, and they don't hold up. In fact, I'd say Maximum Risk was more enjoyable than Hard Target recently.
Oh, God, that's hard to hear.
I know, it is. Honestly, and Universal Soldier is very stiff.
Universal Soldier's rough, yeah. I have revisited that, and I'll agree with you that one is super. That one's cheaper than you remember it, isn't it?
Oh, much, and it's herky-jerky. I mean, that movie starts and stops constantly.
Yeah, the Canadian made-for-TV ones are kick the hell out of this, and that's saying something.
Also, if you go back, like I said, if you look at Van Damme's career in different stages, you have the early stage of Bloodsport, Kickboxer, Cyborg, kind of the holy trinity of his early career. And then you start moving on to the better productions where he did things like Lionheart, Double Impact, Death Warrant. Right. And you know, getting building upon him. And
then, this is all a short period of time as well.
Right. And then
like you know, we just listed like 10 movies, and we're talking in a period of about like
six or seven years.
Honestly,
from about 88 to about 95, 7 years, he came out with probably a dozen movies that were just it's hard to say classics, but to me, because Van Damme for me, in my action hero ranking, let me give you my action hero ranking. Then everyone's just fucking salivating.
We're waiting for it. We've all been waiting for it.
I waited 300 episodes and I finally give it to you. All right. So I got, of course, my man Sly's at the top, right? If you don't fuck with that. The Italian Stallion is number one. But in a close second, I got to admit, I've always had Van Damme and Schwarzenegger kind of on that even tier. And then I would go Willis underneath that. You know, those are kind of the top tier guys. How do you feel?
I don't know. I've never even really counted Willis as an action guy because he's not really.
But Die Hard's so seminal in the genre.
It can be as seminal as it wants to be. It's one movie, you know. He's kind of let me down a lot of stuff. I mean, I do love him in The Fifth Element, but I don't know so much about him. He'd be down on the list. But yeah, I mean, definitely Schwarzenegger's my favorite. And Stallone would be a number two, and Van Damme would be a number three, you know, and Seagal's in there, and. God, who else? You know, there really, when you think back about it, there really aren't that many of them. There's a lot of guys who played in action movies who weren't action stars.
Well, that happened. Makes sense. Which strange, I want to address that as well. I think it's a great point. In 96, when this was failing career-wise for Van Damme because of multiple reasons, not just because of the projects he was picking and whatnot and oversaturation, but for a lot of personal reasons, which we'll get into later. And in Seagal's career was faltering. Guys that in 97 who really shouldn't be playing action heroes were all of a sudden doing that. You had, you know, Nicolas Cage in John Travolta in Face Off, and obviously Nicolas Cage again in Con Air, and a lot of these kind of dramatic actors were starting to take that leap. And then we saw in 99, you know, Keanu Reeves once again reborn himself into an action star. And the action hero, quote unquote, was going back in the drawer after it had been in a reemergence. After Batman.
But yeah, well, I mean, what's the difference between all the guys you just listed and the guys that came before? Clearly the difference is these guys are actors. These other guys, you know, aside from, I would say, Stallone, really, were really weightlifters, you know, and kind of martial artists and stuff. They weren't really actors.
I would say that the guy in the 80s/90s who was the best at juggling action films with acting was probably Mel Gibson.
Oh, without a doubt. But again, he was more an actor. He wasn't.
He was more like Connery in the sense that people viewed him as an actor and not an action star.
I agree with that, but he didn't have his background wasn't in, you know, being a muscle bound kind of guy, martial arts or anything, which is where a lot of these guys came from, right? Who became action stars, especially when you saw, and really that's all because of Asia, right?
Yeah. Heavily.
I mean, in the 70s and 60s, but especially in the 70s, there was that explosion, right? Bruce Lee, all those guys really hit out over here. And this is what it gave birth to, right? It was Van Damme.
And Van Damme is one of those stars that you say that last name, and it's built. I mean, that name is made for putting on posters and in trailers, you know. And
Jean-Claude Van Damme. You'd think it's a terrible name, really, right? I mean, it's long. It's kind of weird to say when it rolls off the tongue, but it's. No one else can be Jean-Claude Van Damme, right?
I mean, this probably was, I mean, the best looking of them. I remember my mom was taking me to see these when I was a kid, and she'd come out and
loved it.
He didn't take off his shirt in that one. She didn't like Hard Target. I specifically remember because he didn't take off his shirt.
Yeah, he certainly was a draw for the women to go see this. I know my mom liked watching Van Damme movies more than any other action star.
My old man liked Seagal, and I always thought it was my old man, my uncle liked Seagal movies, and I swear it was because they could understand him more. They go, I can't understand what that guy's saying.
Yeah, the French accent.
And my uncle go, he's got a big knot on his forehead. I go, well, okay. I mean, I guess he does technically have that knot on his forehead, but I mean, it's my boy Van Damme, you know.
Yeah, it's Van Damme. You know, he was the guy out there. I mean, when you thought of Van Damme, you thought of those kicks, right? And then they're definitely throughout Maximum Risk. He does the high kicks and the sweeping high kicks.
Well, the kind of the helicopter kick was what he was known for. Mm-hmm. The story goes, I'm sure people know if you're following this podcast, how Van Damme was discovered. But after toiling away at carpentry and limo driver and bouncing, Menahem Golan and Golan Globus were having dinner. He was a waiter or bodyguard or bouncer for somebody there, depending on how the story goes. But he got their attention by, as they were leaving the restaurant, he called them out on the street and jumped above Golan's head and did that spinning helicopter kick and then gave him Bloodsport. But Bloodsport was a tumultuous shoot. That was a two-year stuck in editorial hell and was re-edited by Van Damme and Sheldon Lettich, who directed Double Impact and Lionheart. So Van Damme actually had a hand, some would say over of a hand, in directing and editing, which led him to major conflicts with directors and stuff. So the fact that he and Lamb worked together many times leads me to believe that they had a good working relationship. And this is the beginning to me, too, of that Asian trilogy he does with this Double Team and Knockoff. And of those three, this is the most streamlined because the other ones are kind of hallucinogenic.
At which point do the drugs kick in and he just doesn't care anymore?
This is the beginning of the drugs. Yeah. Can you see it in the face? I mean, his body's a little tired,
it looks like. Yeah, he looks like he's a little like, meh.
I'm going to share a story here on air because we're all family. So I got these weightlifting books from back in the day. My friend's uncle is an old school bodybuilder, and I got this Arnold Schwarzenegger weightlifting book that's seriously from him. It has to be his first one he's ever done. It's got a picture of him on the beach looking pre-Conan the Barbarian, early 70s. Now, we live in California, and it's no secret that me and Miss Mary get along pretty well. And there's dispensary services that you call, and you get people to bring it over your house. It's like I had a half-baked for real in California. People out here love it. So this guy comes over one day, this older guy. He's probably in his 50s, pretty big guy. He's dropping off some medicinal, and he looks over at my bookshelf, and he goes, "Hey, I'm in that book." And he goes over, and he grabs this book. And he tells me he's published himself, and he wrote The Unofficial Guide to Steroids. He was a steroid dealer for Franco Colombo, Arnold Schwarzenegger, and he tells me, oh, yeah, and Van Damme, they say he was into coke, but he was really speedballing. I know the guy that sold it to him and this, that, and the other. Goes on. I mean, I'm trying to get the guy on the fucking podcast, to be honest with you, but he's afraid to come on air, so I've been holding the story for a while. So he tells me this, and I'm just, like, blown the fuck away because it kind of looks like he's doing that. It looks more than just coked out. He looks heroin-y in this movie, does he not? I mean, it's there. And in Double Team, he's totally
– he looks sickly. He really looks
terrible. Yeah, I know. And to counterpoint that, Natasha Henstridge looks absolutely gorgeous in this movie.
Yeah, right?
I mean, just flawless.
Yeah, I mean, I agree. And I've always liked her. She's gotten a better actress as she's aged. I'll tell you that much. She's pretty terrible in this. But I've seen her recently in some TV and whatnot. She's actually a decent actress.
When I think of her, obviously Species, because that's where she first caught my attention. Right. When I was about 15, and I was like, "Wow, you know, it really worked for me." And
I did see that one in theaters.
Yeah, so did I. I sat like second row, and I still remember a lot of those scenes. In his formative years, you know. And how I most remember her, though, is I'm a big fan of Saturday Night Live, which I'm sure most people know if they listen to this podcast, but. The show VIP used to come on Channel 4 after Saturday Night Live when I was younger. We'd watch Saturday Night Live and then go once again, party a little bit and come back in the house. And that would be on. And we just would watch it and just stare in disbelief at how fucking bad that show was. You remember that show? VIP?
No. She was
it VIP?
That.
No, it was the other spies. One. She Spies. God, it was as interchangeable. Because you know what? They switched off sometimes. Yeah. That's like saying fucking Baywatch Nights and Sunset Blues or whatever that shit was. You know what I mean? Like, nobody remembers.
Yeah, She Spies is so bad, it's kind of good at this point.
She Spies was bad. Fucking bad. Yeah. This was also the last good movie, I think, that Van Damme had released theatrically. Because after this, you would have Double Team, Knockoff, and then maybe the most disappointing out of all of them because it was touted as the comeback movie and he was going to be clean for it. And it was just so bad was Universal Soldier The Return. A movie so bad that they don't even act like it's part of the canon in any other follow-ups. So bad.
Yeah. And then it went straight to video.
And has not rebounded out of that since the Expendables 2, which was really, you know, a gift from Stallone.
But I mean, to be honest, I certainly have liked a lot of the things he's done as of recent, you know, obviously JCVD. Is going to be one. You've liked a lot of the others.
I found them watchable. I think that really, though, the ones you mentioned, Replicant, In Hell, I know you don't like Wake of Death, but I would put those at the top tier of that.
You're going to tell me they were watchable, but then you're going to start naming a bunch of horrible ones that you vehemently fight me over.
Well, check this out.
I knew it.
Give me this, that Van Damme's B-movie career is way less toxic than Seagal's.
It is, only because it really flies under the radar. You know, Seagal, you see Bam Bam Bam, Seagal, Steven Seagal, they sell the shit out of those. Where the fuck are the Van Damme movies at? You know, they're just
not, that
they're
prolific.
Not to be seen. Yeah. Well, they also don't throw them in your face when he makes one. It's really, you almost have to, in a sense, seek them out. You know, Welcome to the Jungle had almost, and to be fair, it's not really his movie, but it had like no release at all, right? And a lot of them didn't, you know.
Seagal films now are known for him not doing any ADR, so it's a different guy.
Well, even the Universal Soldier, like Day of Reckoning, though, had practically no publicity.
God, that's a good one, though. Anybody, that's
it is very good. But again, like I was saying, it had like no publicity compared to a Seagal movie, which you would see everywhere.
Yeah, and Redbox would be all over it too. So, let's get to the heart of the matter here. Let's talk Maximum Risk and the movie. And
you want to hit the opening scene here?
Yeah, let's get at it.
Yeah, what do you think about this opening scene? I really loved this. This reminded me of why I like movies from the 90s, where you just got a car chase going on, a guy with a camera, you know, some dudes driving, and that's it, right? And I tell you, when they go down the stairs in this, you can feel that, can't you? I don't know. In movies nowadays, when they go downstairs, it's everything's so smooth. They like seem to kind of glide, even if it's the car shaking around. It doesn't seem as weighty as this did.
This was it's a great setup to show you the city and then have the intimacy of a guy huffing and puffing along, and you feel alone. You know, you really you watch that and you go, oh man, I feel kind of like with this guy. And then it's the classic Van Damme.
They pull it off from under you, though.
And he's doing things in here that are not Jason Bourne-esque, because there's consequences to everything he's doing. He's getting the shit kicked out.
He's a regular guy.
Right, exactly. And they kill him right off the bat, which had been done in Universal Soldier, if you remember. It's the only other movie he got killed in the first 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Which always reminded me of that. But great, great chasing to open this movie up.
But it is a good way to kind of throw a little something in there.
There's so much visual energy in the beginning of this movie that it can't quite sustain it, and it doesn't. But that beginning does show you that, like, this isn't going to be – I mean, if you look at it now and you go, okay, the Bourne movies or the shaky cam and stuff. But this was Asian influence before we had
this.
Well,
there was no shaky cam in this, right? There was just – the shaky cam was just subsequent
– it was because the camera was –
it was just because it was shaking. Yeah. They didn't do it on purpose, right? I mean, that's why I think it made this work so much, because – nothing in this was necessarily faked to any degree. You know, it was just shot. You know, and I really love that. I love when scenes in car chases, when the car bumps the camera too. Doesn't that just kind of add a little bit to it? I don't know.
Well,
for me, it does.
Any car chase like this from this era and further back, you're looking for like the fruit stand, you know, or like the glass. He's driving the fruit cart is what I love in this one. You know, he's just, fuck it, I got the fruit cart with me.
Well, they do one really, really smart thing in this. He's Russian and they give him no lines.
Yes.
they're like, Van Damme doing a Russian accent? No, give him no lines, just kill him.
I didn't even think about that. Yeah. And I love later when she tells the brother, you know, you've gotten so much harder since you've been away. And it's like, nah, he's the same fucking, literally the same physique, lady.
Yeah, right.
Before we go any further here, let's take a quick break and let our listeners hear the trailer for 1996's Maximum Risk. We'll be right back with you.
If you're playing this tape, then I'm already dead. You're my only hope. They're watching. They're waiting. Take the money, the list, and the gun. And when you shoot, shoot to kill.
Somebody killed him. It was strength to come home.
This is just the beginning. I've seen it before. They won't stop until you're dead, too.
From internationally acclaimed action director Ringo Lam. Jean-Claude Van Damme and Natasha Henstridge of Species. Maximum Risk. Welcome to to the other side of Safe.
All right, and we're back. So an interesting side note here. Watching this trailer and looking at the promotional materials, the original poster, you know, they have the World Trade Center front and center on this thing. And I got to believe, I had a suspicion, and I went and looked it up. Now, was it? Where do you think this was shot? Because it takes place in France and New York. Where do you think this was shot?
Canada.
Yep, Canada and a little bit of France. Because this thing, outside of some stock footage shots of you know, the subway train, some electric rails and the Twin Towers and things like that, it all takes place in Canada. This has no look.
But you can't really tell. I mean, very it's foreign. All I'd say, street level and kind of up
it
close.
It has a very foreign feel, though. Does it not feel like a
it does,
European
but
art film?
I kind of was okay with that because it starts in Europe. So I don't know. When he went to, when they went to – I mean, I'll be honest. When they went to New York, I was like, oh, damn, they weren't in New York?
I know. I mean,
I had no idea where they were.
I always remember it starts in France because the little, like, the balconies are, like, so European. You're like, oh.
Right, and his friend is the most French person in the world.
First of all, his sidekick, is that not Roman Polanski? Who the fuck is that guy?
It's Jean-Hugues Anglade or whatever. He's the only reason I know him is because he was in two of the early Luc Besson movies. But he was he played a character in La Femme Nikita. He was the boyfriend that she found.
Oh, dropping some fucking knowledge tonight, man. I like
it. It's the only reason I know him. I don't think he's done anything else, you know, stateside. He's a French guy, but
he's got a great line in this movie that goes completely under the radar. When he says, "Parents always lie to their children. That's to prepare them for how the government's going to treat them later." What? Where did that come from in this movie? It's like the smartest, most George Clooney line that ever fucking came out.
I mean, just to skip ahead and just you know, let's go through the through line with this guy at the end. Were you happy, or did you even notice that they kind of missed or stepped over the opportunity of turning him into a bad guy?
I like that they didn't because they.
Me too. I thought, oh man. Because I really didn't really remember this too much. I thought, oh, fuck, this guy's going to be a bad guy, isn't he?
No,
he's
just
fooling around.
Just
but he's not.
There.
Yeah, he's just fucking there. And I was like, oh, thank God.
Because if you think about it, the Van Damme character that we know the whole movie, you don't learn anything about. You understand why he really
did
this shit about the brother.
But this guy's the guy that led him to that, right? I mean, how easy would it have been for this guy to have been a bad guy? Very
My question
easy.
Is, whose funeral is Van Damme at in the beginning?
Right?
You always think it's the brother's, and you're like, oh, no, he's pulling him away to go see the brother. Like, who the fuck is this, you know, guy? And it turns out to be, they said, like, a lieutenant or a major.
I was just
going to
say, I think it was, like, the captain or something. Or someone in the police force.
One of the most interesting things is that this was written by Larry Ferguson, who wrote Beverly Hills Cop, The Hunt for October, co-writer on Alien 3, a lot of stuff he was writing. And this script had a polish by – an uncredited polish by Jason Friedberg and Adam Seltzer, the guys from the Scary Movie franchise. And you can almost feel that irreverent tone in a couple scenes, and particularly the cabbie novelist, who's my favorite character in this entire movie.
But he's just – doesn't he seem so inserted?
That's what I mean. It's a rewrite character.
So
I fucking
weird.
Love it.
He's There's in no there. Reason for his it's existence. So weird that he dies too. And like, are we supposed to be sad about that? Like, I barely knew the guy.
And he's given like a moment, you know?
I know. It's a big moment. And it's like, it's one of those things where in a movie nowadays, there's no way they would have killed that guy. Or if they were going to kill him, they would have made him really beloved.
They would at least gave him another scene or so. Yeah, like another couple of movies. But I love that he was the novelist and he's looking for this and he could find anything. And he's, I'm not going to steal your story. This would have been great to set up the
Here's the thing, though. What does he do in the movie? He doesn't do anything. He saves him that one time, right? But other than that, he tells him, like, you know, find Alex or whatever. And he fucking, of course, doesn't do that. And then he's just kind of there. And then he gets killed.
I think the Natasha Henstridge character is probably the most depressing character. If you listen to what she did, she's a former stripper turned hostess in this Russian mafia joint where she's fucked. Like, she's eventually going to have to do something with this mafia guy or not. Like, she kind of is like in this quasi sex slave ring, I feel like, with this whole situation. And her character is useless. She ends up fucking her ex-boyfriend's brother, has really no qualms with the fact that the Mikhail's dead.
Yeah, no, she's moved right on.
Moved on.
Well, he looks just like him, so it's fine. And the accent's probably sexier, right? Going from Russia to French. Annie's harder.
Is that one of the is that one of the main selling points with Van Damme? Because he could have lost that accent, but is that like one of the signature things? Like Schwarzenegger always said, like he could have probably shook it fully, but it was his trademark.
I definitely think so. I mean, Jean-Claude Van Damme, right? The dude's fucking French. Like that's kind of the whole persona.
All right, story number two. Let me show you another Van Damme story for full. This one comes from. My buddy who I want to get on the show, he's probably going to be listening to this. I should probably wait for him to come on the show to tell the story, but I'm going to do a bad impersonation of it. He tells me he's hanging out with a very famous friend of his, a guy he grew up with who's a professional athlete. And they're in an East Coast town. I can't say what because I can't put it on blast like that. But the guy's a professional. If you say the name, you know who it was. And he stays very close to his entourage. And you've met this guy, I believe. In fact, and you in his room's with this guy. So – long story short, they're at a gym working out, and Van Damme's there. And they, Van Damme's lady publicist comes over to the group and says, Mr. Van Damme would like to meet you. And so Van Damme comes walking over. And as my buddy tells the story, he says, the guy looks fucking coked out of his mind. He looks awful, he says, just absolutely he's dying. And he goes, and he walks over, and he doesn't say, hey, guys, how you doing, or yeah, what's going on? The first thing he says, as in the most grimy, creepy way, is, so, did you guys fuck last night? And he says the publicist, like in horror, he like rushed him away and shit. And they were just like, what the fuck? And these guys were all our age and like grew up in Van Damme movies and the whole nine. So, you know, I hope my friend out there doesn't mind giving that story away, because when he comes on, he can do a much better detailed description of that. But, you know, it just it reminds you that that. Underneath all of this, there was always a layer of creepiness that accompanied Van Damme. I mean, all the stories of him and all the trouble he was in. And
maybe that's the real reason he kept the French accent.
Because when you say, do you want to fuck, it sounds
like. Yeah, it's like, hey, he's creepy. Nah, he's European.
It sounds like Pepe Le Pew. My impersonation, at least. We got to say, though, that this movie somewhat resets itself midway through, wouldn't you say? With the bathhouse sequence, when you realize...
Well, the greatest sequence of the movie, you mean?
Thank you. I do think that this bathhouse sequence the best acted, the best written, shot, edited, and that fight scene with that beast of an individual. It's just great.
Yeah, I mean, you get a great action scene between, you know, Van
the guy's
Damme
name
and...
is Stefanos Miloskovic. I'm sorry, I'm screwing that off. He's an MMA grappler, and he also has a small role as one of the pirates in Cyborg, if you go back and watch. He's in that too. He's been in a number of Van Damme movies in the background. He's got to be a friend of Van Damme. He's one of the original pioneers of MMA and UFC stuff.
That is an interesting fight that takes place. It moves from the sauna area to like the shower room.
But so did
it goes so far away,
just like the first one did in that movie with the whole office when they're all over that office. You know, like I love that he just beats his ass for a second, then he leaves in the bath. You know, he like walks out with him. He's like, "No, I'm done with you." But that the sequence is great,
great
because
scene.
The whole turn of power too. You realize that the bad guy really wasn't after him.
Well, you get your action movie, and then you also get a little mafia hit going on here, right? Taking out the mob boss, pretty cool.
This is arguably the weakest villain though in all the Van Damme movies. Isn't that
he's
the
not even really
movie?
A villain?
But there's no villain.
He doesn't
that's...
do anything. Well, here's the thing: where's all of his henchmen at? Where is he kills all the boss and all the boss's henchmen? He's got like two dudes, and like that's it.
And he's running a little ragged.
That's all that's left of the Russian mafia out of the 12 guys that were there.
I think out of all action movies that have like the spiraling bad guy that do it best for me is Out for Justice with Richie, you know, with William Forsythe. This is a Seagal movie. I love that he's – because that guy just – if you watch that movie, I'm going to have to do a retro on that soon because he's just on a 48-hour crack binge that says, like, I'm not going to be alive in 48 hours. I'm going fucking all out, you know, like – and that you feel that shit. Like, and no one's safe at that point. Whereas these other guys just seem like they're playing tough guys. And the two FBI henchmen here and the whole list and getting – this movie's confused in the fact that it goes from France to New York and then just basically has to get him back to where he was in the first place to go to a bank. If he had just gone to that fucking bank, he'd have saved himself a lot of fucking trouble.
Yeah, I know he has, well,
what was on the list in the end? I didn't even pay attention to it, this list that everybody was after. What was on the list?
Well, it was everyone's I mean, it was everyone who was involved in it, right? And so it was the FBI, the dirty cops were on it. That's why they were after it.
Who really are the bad guys in the end, because they're the ones that killed the brother, in a sense.
Right, right. Well, I mean, if anything, it's good to see where Paul Blart came from. Yeah, you know, and to just, you know, Kevin James was working before.
You know, yeah, that guy does look nice very much like that character. That's for sure. But you say that about the bathhouse scene, and it made me think about other great action movies that have a good bathhouse sequence. Showdown in Little Tokyo, yep. Bullet to the Head, obviously this. I mean, the bathhouse sequence, I mean, I don't know. I've never been in a bathhouse in my fucking life, but great – at least I'm not going to be on air. Great sequence, though, for movies.
Yeah, I mean, I would agree. Yeah, definitely. Especially from this age, right? I mean, if you go back, Red Heat obviously had the same thing. But
Red Heat.
But Russia, right? Is that kind of a tie, like a European tie with this?
Maybe.
Because wasn't in Bullet to the Head, it was also a Russian thing, wasn't it? Wasn't he going to...
You're very right. But in Showdown in Little Tokyo, it was a Japanese theme. It was Yakuza. Theme at bathhouses.
Sure, there. But still, that's foreign.
Yeah, I gotcha.
Right.
Showdown in Little Tokyo. Here's another classic. Man, we're just stumbling upon gems tonight, huh? Let's take a quick break, and I want you guys to listen to Siskel and Ebert. We tried to dig up an old review of theirs for this film, but we couldn't exactly find one. All I could find was them riffing on the generic titles in movies of this era and of this time bunched together. So go ahead and listen to that. We'll be right back.
And now my thumb revolves and points down for a new syndrome in the movies, interchangeable, forgettable titles for action pictures that sound like they come out of a computer file of action-filled words, and it wouldn't surprise me that that's exactly how they're created. Some examples, how about Extreme Measures, which opened last week? It's about a mad genius scientist played by Gene Hackman who uses the homeless as guinea pigs for genetic surgery through the spinal column. Now, I know Spinal Tap as a title was already taken, but Extreme Measures is so lame. Would it matter if it were titled Chain Reaction or Maximum Risk? Not much. And those are actual titles of other generic thrillers from this year. Now, these generic titles cost producers revenue, I think. I may have gotten their attention finally. How can the average moviegoer remember titles like these? And these boring titles also send a sadly accurate signal to moviegoers that the movie isn't really about anything special. It's so generic, it gets the equivalent of a barcode you find on a box of cereal.
Oh, I know what you mean, Gene. People ask me about movies, and I can't remember what one they're talking about. Fatal Attraction or Fatal Beauty? Or Basic Instinct or Basic Attraction? Or Fatal Instinct? Yeah. By the time you get finished with all these movies, it's just like they put a lot of words into a box and shook it up. And then there was that satire on those kinds of movies. Remember what it was called?
I have no idea.
You don't? Gee, neither do I. But it was something like Fatal Basic Instinct or Attraction or something like that.
All right. And we're back with you guys. I mean, they're talking about Extreme Measures. They're talking about Chain Reaction, Maximum Risk. And they're basically saying that it hurt the box office of all these films that underperformed because audiences couldn't tell them apart, and basically saying that it was too much work. You think that's the problem here? That why this didn't do well?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, I think the problem is that it's just this is extremely cheap. You know, there's no – clearly people stopped trying at this point. I don't know how it happened. I don't know where it happened, but it happened, as you mentioned, with everyone, really. You know, the late 90s was not a good time for really any action star.
No, and you look – like I said, I particularly point out 97 because, like I said, that was the year that Travolta and – Cage both did action films, and you have people like Stallone doing a dramatic film with Copland, you know, and it just was such a strange summer to me. And I that was really the beginning of the end of the action hero, because once The Matrix came out and all the wire work, it didn't matter who the guy was. You didn't need to be able to do a spinning back kick to get people's attention.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like you could.
Well, they wanted the special effects.
The bullet time, you know, which was one of the worst things that could have happened to action films, because after that, everything from Art of War to Shrek, it had bullet time, you know? It was unfucking believable.
That was pretty crazy. Yeah, and something that you couldn't imagine being in a lot of movies before then. An odd effect, yeah.
It worked well for The Matrix, but it didn't need to be incorporated into everything else.
It worked great for The Matrix, but yeah.
To give Maximum Risk just a little bit of clarity here, it was originally titled The Exchange, and then Bloodstone, both terrible titles.
Action movies have always had a problem with titles, haven't they? I mean, Maximum Risk, it has nothing to do with anything.
Yeah,
it's just, it doesn't. But all of them, I mean, if you even go back to the ones that we say we liked. It's just, they're terrible, terrible titles.
Even Sudden Death, which I think is probably the glossiest.
I mean, come on, Double Team. I would say,
don't you think Sudden Death and Time Cop are the two, like, high points of the career in a sense of like real movies?
Yeah. I mean, I agree. Everything's building to that.
Yeah. Every step.
I would completely agree with that. Everything is building to that, and it's unfortunate that the next thing after that really is, you know, is this.
The first step, I believe, you know, not even addressing the massive drug problem. Van Damme will say, well, let's address it. I mean, I read an interview with him once, and he said he was doing up to 5 grams a day. That's not my forte, that whole arena, so I don't know what that cost is or whatever, but I got to imagine that's substantial. But he said he wanted to commit suicide. He eventually was diagnosed in 99 with manic bipolar, mm-hmm. and was on medication and is somewhat gotten his life together. But if you ever watched his television show that they did following him around, you can still see the guy's drinking and partying, and he's gotten multiple DUIs. So I don't know what his sobriety is or what his whole deal is with that. But it's so sad, and the fact that, like, the guy was so good looking, was so talented, was great shape, and you see him now, and I mean, I follow him on Instagram and all those kind of social media things, mm-hmm. and he's very young to be looking as old as he looks. I mean, Stallone and Schwarzenegger are much older, and they all look about the same age.
I know, right?
It's really sad.
Isn't that crazy?
Yeah, it makes you feel bad for him in a sense, because I don't want to say I looked up to the guy, but he was one of my action idols, you know, when you're a kid. I didn't necessarily follow wrestling or any of that kind of stuff or you know, sports in the sense of football heroes or stuff. But Van Damme was my guy, and Seagal was a guy too. And Seagal was the guy that everybody liked because he didn't have to work out, right? And look where that got him. Like, who would you want to be today? That's the question. Seagal or Van Damme? Go.
Can I be John Travolta?
Yeah.
Nicolas Cage?
I'll be Nicolas Cage. He's choking motherfuckers out still. You see him get after Vince Neil?
No.
Oh, man. Get on TMZ once in a while, will you?
No, I won't.
Yeah, no. Do yourself a favor. Don't. Keep your brain cells.
No.
But honestly, Van Damme was a bad boy actor in the era before TMZ. Yeah, there was tabloids and stuff, and he was fodder for tabloids with his 5 divorces and remarrying his second wife and kids all over the place. But nowhere – I mean, if it had been this era, he'd have been just – can you imagine the shit? It's like a Lindsay Lohan type situation. Yeah, he'd have been all over it.
Well, but, I mean, it would have been Charlie Sheen, right?
Well, good thing he pulled it together, though, right? I mean, you didn't know if he was still going to be around in the late 90s, man. Because I'm telling you, you look at Double Team, and he mm-hmm. looks very sick. He does not look well.
Yeah.
And but, man, these movies were just – up until this point, you really – they just were so fucking good. Time Cop? Go back and look at that shit, man. Time Cop. So I don't know if I'm reviewing Maximum Risk tonight or his whole oeuvre, the overture. Right? It's like, but I don't know. Are you going positive with this? Are you going to be happy to revisit this thing or what?
Yeah, I mean, ultimately, yes. This isn't, this is no Criterion Collection worthy fucking movie. Obviously,
but you had this on Blu-ray and you said it looked great.
Oh my God. First of all, if you do get a chance to see, yeah, I mean, both this and, Glimmer Man looks great on Blu-ray too.
You own that on Blu-ray?
Yeah, I have that.
What are you somewhere. Fucking burning money over there? What do you got going on?
I had another one, too.
I better find those in a dollar bin at Walmart.
Oh, yeah. I've had them for a while. I mean, this was unopened. So it's a good thing to watch it. But it's a beautiful transfer. And Ringo Lam's framing on this, or whoever the hell was, you know, I don't know if it's him. I imagine it would be him. He's an action director, but whoever the cameraman was on this just framed the shit out of this. Like, it's a beautiful, you know, widescreen 2.35 frame. And the whole movie's just like, oh, wow, that's great framing.
Unfortunately, I did not get to experience that because my DVD, which was like one of the original DVDs I ever bought, is a terrible transfer. Let me look at the specs on this piece of shit. It is a 1.33 full screen, and it's not even, it doesn't even fill up my entire frame. I had to adjust like the setting on my TV to stretch the fucker to make it even resemble a normal movie. So, because originally it looked like I was peeping through the cracks of a door at a theater to watch it. It's so tall and narrow. So it was not the greatest viewing experience for me. And I've been looking at this Blu-ray flirting with getting it, but I thought, oh, how often am I going to watch Maximum Risk? this would have been the time. Why is it that there's a Maximum Risk Blu-ray, there's a Glimmer Man Blu-ray, but there's still no True Lies Blu-ray? Can anyone explain that to me?
Yeah, I know, right? Why?
It makes no sense.
Why does it not exist?
But yeah, this does make me want to go back, though, and look at some more Van Damme films. You were talking about going back and looking at Nowhere to Run, and I can't abide by that. I looked at that for reasons. And I'm telling you, it's such a different era that these things just don't hold up the way you remember. I mean, 20 years ago now for Maximum Risk is unbelievable to me. I mean, two decades.
I don't know. They cleaned this one up too. So,
but that overhead swirling shot when he's in the vault listening, basically the trailer shot.
Sure.
That's another great, great shot here. And this movie, like I said, has a lot of visual inventiveness. Not quite the manic energy of Sui Hark, you know, that does Double Team and Knock Off. And Knock Off is probably – wouldn't you agree that Knock Off is probably the strangest movie Van Damme's ever been involved with?
Yeah, Knock Off is weird. But, I mean, what do you expect at that point?
Because Double Team has a cool idea in, like, that colony – but then it goes away from that. You know, I like that idea. But then it's like when they parachute out in those basketballs, parachute from that. Yeah. Like it's just like, oh, wow, you guys are pandering as fuck in this movie. But yeah, God, it just – there was a time, though, Van Damme would open a movie and it was number one at the box office, and this was the last time that happened. So translated, by the way, this grossed about $28 to $30 million. So even today, this would be considered a low grosser and a money loser, unfortunately. And the last movie that Natasha Henstridge would be in the theaters, except for a small role in Species 2. Did you ever see Species 2? I saw that in the theater. I saw way too many movies in the theater.
I didn't see it in the theaters.
No?
No.
Oh, you missed that. Me and three other people did.
Yeah. I don't know why. How the hell did you watch that?
I worked in a theater at the time, I think. I was free. It was one of those things.
No, Ghost of Mars.
Ghost of Mars. Nice to come back with one.
I mean, the whole nine yards she was in.
You're fucking unbelievable. You're called names of movies sometimes, but you got the French guy from the Luc Besson movie. You got Natasha Henstridge from Ghost of Mars. I'm proud of you tonight.
Nine yards.
Look at you.
Yeah. Oh, wait, the sequel, right?
Whole 10 yards?
So there's three movies.
Wow.
Yeah, she's in that one too.
She had a whole career.
So there you go. Well, you said she wasn't back in the theaters again. Boy, were you wrong.
To be fair, she's about as supporting as they get in a cameo-esque in the whole nine yards and the whole 10 yards.
Yeah, she is just the extra like girlfriend, just kind of there because she needs to be.
Well, that's going to wrap up our retrospective tonight on the 1996 Jean-Claude Van Damme film Maximum Risk. Yes, we know this was a very obscure title to go back and look at, but hey, we picked it. Next week, we'll be back with you guys with a regular episode, episode 300, if you can believe it. Yeah, yeah. And we'll have some special guests on after and some fun stuff coming up with you guys. So stay with us. We want to thank you all for continuing listening with us. You can check us out at iTunes, Stitcher, TalkShoe, and a bunch of other podcast sites. Thanks, guys, and we'll be back with you soon.
Oh, my. Another magnificent episode has come to an end. If you're craving more, set your destination to MovieMavericks.com, Warp 9. Engage!